Well, in the first half of our session together, we took a look at the nature of conversations within the various different communities represented here on death and dying and advanced care planning in terms of the present context. And in the second session now, we want to take our attention to move it more towards the future in terms of what actions can help and promote conversations within the communities and what policies, programs, and supports could be developed or are being developed regarding advanced care planning, communities of care, grief and bereavement. But I also want to note that we didn't spend any time on grieving a loss or grief and bereavement in the first session. We didn't have a chance to get there. So it's something that we want to take a look at here now too. But we'll look at it in terms of both what is taking place now as well as what's being proposed for the future. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to give us a summary of how they understand grief and bereavement taking place in their communities and where simultaneously also looking at where they think it's going or where it could go. And let's get it started from that perspective and see where it takes us. And then after that, we'll also take a look at how we can focus on advanced care planning in a future-oriented way. So, Randolph, Reverend Bruce, if you would start us off, that would be great.
Sure, thank you. Welcome back. So, grief and bereavement. Many years ago, a group of Anglicans in Coquitlam and Burnaby and Burquitlam began what now is the Burnaby Hospice Society bereavement counseling out of Burquitlam Funeral Home. And Randy McCormick and the McCormick family. And that branched out into St. Lawrence, where there was a group, again, doing bereavement with Anglicans and the Jewish community in Coquitlam. Out of that came the Burnaby Hospice Society, in which they work very extensively with the hospice at St. Michael's. And so they have volunteers who go through a training program, and they also have provide grieving support services and counseling. So we have a whole package that we have at the hospice at St. Michael's that we can hand on to folks when we identify through the social worker, through myself, through the RN, through the doctor, and other people on the team that someone is struggling with grief and loss. I have also produced a couple of pamphlets on grief and loss, dealing with the whole area of loss of control. I've always said that the churches, we don't do two things very well. We don't prepare people for marriage very well, okay, because we have people coming from different whatevers, and we get together, and it's usually a clash. And we don't prepare people well for retirement and for loss of control. We don't prepare, for example, anyone very well for having to give up their driver's license. Having to give up a relationship of any kind is grief. So giving up a relationship to come into healthcare, you've given up your garden, your kitchen, your workshop, your golf, your driver's license, your dog, your cat, your hobby, whatever. All those are grief moments. And we don't prepare folks well for those moments. They're little blips on the highway, like a little speed bump that we go over. But when you get a bunch of them in a row, it can seem like a very huge mountain. And so that's part of the work that we do at Burnaby, at our hospice at St. Michael's, through the Burnaby Hospice Society. They also help us with that. And also I do a lot of that myself, a lot of one-on-one and talking with patients, talking with residents, talking with families, helping them to look at those moments. Sometimes somebody is angry. A resident is angry. They're not really angry, they're grieving. And that's an educational moment for the staff and I think for everybody involved in palliative care. So that's where we are. And so in terms of grief and loss, I also do, I'm available to do helping to plan a service of life, a celebration of life, to do funerals, to help with those arrangements, to be there to help the family with those arrangements. All that kind of stuff is part of my responsibility as well at St. Michael's. And so that takes up some of my time in terms of just helping people navigate that system, but also giving them a safe place to talk about their grief. I used to have a sign on my door at St. Michael's that has said, you know, just like Vegas, what happens here stays here. And so it gives a chance for staff also, because I found that I need to spend some time with staff, helping them in the grieving process, particularly in hospice, because hospice is usually a 3-month stay, but we've had people who stayed for as much as a year. And you build up these relationships, and then to help the staff work through their own grief, or also to help the staff work through a grief, the loss of even a colleague. It's going to be a grief moment for them. So that's part of the things that I do and we do at St. Michael's Hospice.
Thanks, Randolph. Is there anything you'd like to say about future developments with respect to any of that?
Future developments in terms of, well, we obviously need education. We need help with education within cultures, because there's still a perception out there that when you come into palliative care hospice, it's not, some people still see it as cure. Now, we've had miracles. We had a gentleman come in at 10%. And after 2 months, he was back in the community. He moved out to the community. He was back playing with his band. But we have people who come in who think that this is cure. It's not end of life. And so there's issues around that in culture. So issues around trying to get certain cultural folks to understand that we do not feed because of aspiration. We do not give fluids. We do up pain control. There's all kinds of cultural stuff around that where if I'm not respecting, I'm not feeding my mom, my dad, my grandma, my grandpa, I'm not giving them water, I'm not respecting them. And there's a whole area of education needs to be done around that. I think the churches need some help with that from their professionals to help us understand how we can get that message out. And then the other thing that's really important is understanding. And so I find there's a lack of understanding amongst the staff of the faith traditions and what the expectations are when it comes to dying. What is it that the individual wants? So what is it there in their faith tradition that connects them to that sense of their spirituality that we can provide them with the comfort? And if we don't know what it is and then we see it and think it's foreign, that's not helpful. So there's a whole bunch of education needs to be done around understanding different faith traditions, different customs. We had a gentleman who came in who was a Hare Krishna. And so the music therapist and I learned the chant and we spent chanting time with him, which was a good thing to do. But if I hadn't asked that question, he would have felt very, very alone. And then other people said to me, well, why are you doing that? And I said, because it's part of my responsibility and it's your responsibility. So we need some education around those things. So just about, you know, end of life, you know, feeding, pain, water, support, letting people know that an increase in medication is not euthanasia. It's comfort measures. So, you know, the Anglican Church, we hope that people would respect and understand autonomy and understand that sometimes it's okay to stop something if it's no longer being an improvement. It's okay to walk with that person and do that and to support them if that is their wishes. So we need some education. And also, I guess, even in terms of helping with some language if we're going to put stuff into different languages. Would it be a good place to have a conversation within the church? And so I'm going to go back to my leadership within the church and say, you know what, we need to have some conversations around these issues in our parishes and bring the issue out to the forefront and get some help from this association to educate our folks.
Thank you. Elaine, what's happening with the Catholics in the present and the future regarding grief and bereavement?
Bereavement first? Well, at least in my church, we don't have bereavement groups such as Renata was describing. But as I think about it, I think like our funerals are usually sort of, I guess, upbeat because we're celebrating life, eh? And a good death, hopefully. But I think that maybe in the future, maybe this is something we could be establishing. I think we now, I'm just speaking from my own personal experience in my own church and the friends who in other churches, but there's a strong sense of support. Like last night, I just heard a friend of mine has just gone into hospital to have gallbladder. So on the way home, of course, I will go and see how she's doing. But this is it's sort of an informal type of thing, but I think there's a lot of support, but not an actual grieving group for particularly people who are maybe on their own, don't have families, as Gloria had mentioned. So that may be something in the future we want to look at. It was also pointed out to me down at St. Paul's when I was down for a meeting recently that, you know, not specifically maybe just to do with palliative care or end of life, but just generally, we're going to have to have conversations about the growing numbers of baby boomers that are entering into where they need medical help now and probably help with dying and issues too. So that's another area that, you know, we'll need education with. We're also started now in our medical places, we've started having a spiritual convener, like what do we call them? Anyway, they're a staff person that looks after the spiritual elements, particularly in our hospices, but just in our general acute care and so on. So there are things that are constantly having to be talked about because the future does, you know, we're moving faster and faster and things are changing more and more. And the needs don't change. They increase, I think. One of the things that we do to try to make this whole area of availability, we're sort of looking at, and also comfort, we're looking at hoping and maybe working with especially residential care units to have a hospice area in them, whether they're a faith one or a public one, because people, about 80% we find, want to die at home. And if people have been in a residential area or a residential care place, the home is that. They may have been there for 2 years. So that's home. So that's an area that we're sort of looking at. Is there any way we can make them able to die at home, being the residential care? So these are some of the areas. But the other thing is more and more in our hospitals generally, we're trying to increase the staff input. We're having more, what do you think we need to do to solve some of these problems? And I think that's a growing trend, probably in all hospitals. I can only speak for our own. But where and lots of problems are solved by throwing them out to the people who are feet on the ground working on it. So it's just a matter of us taking advantage of all of that talent that we have right already in our nurses and our medical staff.
Well, Elaine, you didn't mention your spiritual care practitioners, but you have the best ratio of spiritual care practitioners, what we used to call chaplains, of any group in BC. I just want to mention that. You've done a great job of that.
So. Thank you. I didn't want to mention that stat because it sounds like I'm bragging.
Okay, let's move over to this side of the room now. And Dr. Dosa, you have some comments that you can make regarding the present state and the future of grief and bereavement in the Islamic community, and with reference to your research, perhaps?
Yes, I think we need to make a distinction that, you know, the communities that you talk about, they are well-established communities. Yes. With respect to racialized minorities, they still feel very much confined to their own community resources when it comes to grief and bereavement. So I think the first step, and I am kind of making suggestions because, you know, whatever is in place is very informal. So I will also kind of trade a fine line between the two. So in terms of suggestions, I think we need to kind of expand the parameters of the community. So not to kind of consider communities to have rigid boundaries, but if, for example, you have someone who has expertise in grieving and loss, it should be drawn into the community. Mm-hmm. And likewise, it should be reciprocal, because racialized minorities also have a lot of contribution to make by virtue of the fact that they are diasporic communities. They have long-established customs and traditions from other countries, other geopolitical terrains. And so they have a wealth of experience which is never, ever recognized. So what I would suggest is, or if it comes to grieving and bereavement, if we can blur the boundaries between formal counseling and informal resources that are available within the community. That would be one aspect. The second aspect would be actually to ensure that people who are grieving are not constructed as victims. So I think that one area that the community has just begun to address is what is meaningful for that person. For example, it could be that the person who is deceased from the family may have had some kind of a meaningful activity. Like for a woman, it could be crocheting, embroidery work, knitting, religious recitations. So if those aspects are emphasized and if those aspects are being talked about, that's another way of, you know, dealing, coping with grief and loss. I don't know whether I'm just kind of going beyond the boundary, but I think we need to recognize that there is a market model in place. We live a very fast-paced life, and we don't talk about it. Time is at a premium. And so when it comes to grieving and bereavement, sometimes we find that even if we want to spend time with individuals who are going through this experience, we are conflicted. And this is what I hear from the communities when I'm doing research. Where is the time? How can we spare the time when we have to work, when there are families with two incomes? And the other aspect that I think we need to talk about this, I think it's the neoliberal model that actually puts a lot of emphasis on self-care, that puts a lot of emphasis on communities taking on responsibilities that are actually should belong to the state. We are citizens of a particular nation and we have entitlements, but we don't recognize this because the neoliberal model, which is global, has actually dwindled our welfare state. And I think that if we are genuinely interested in doing this work, we need to actually take this into account, that there are minimum resources that are available for grieving and bereavement. I don't know whether you have encountered this and you find that fewer and fewer people are left with the responsibility of engaging into counseling when we do need a wide repertoire of resources. So tapping into informal resources would also be very, very useful. So essentially, this is what I have to say, and I'm looking forward to your questions so we can have more discussion on this.
Thank you. Dr. Gutman, Gloria.
Well, within the LGBT community, of course, there are people that are dealing with guilt of the survivors, right? And so there is a need, I would think, for some counseling of those people who lived through the AIDS epidemic and who now are having some of those same issues rekindled by having contemporaries who are dying. So that's one area that I would see needing development for the future. In terms of education, I think we have a huge way to go, both in educating staff of care provider staff at all levels, as well as educating other people. You know, just because you get old doesn't mean you get nice. And you know, one of the issues for people in the LGBT community is both discrimination from staff and also discrimination or bullying from other residents. So that's something needs to be recognized and dealt with. And then there is the other very large issue of recognizing who is the family and who is the partner of the LGBT person, and to enable grief counseling to be delivered to the husband in a gay relationship with a partner. And to take into consideration, like Reverend Bruce was saying, that in his place, he ran into a situation where there was a gay couple, and the partner was written down in their records, instead of being as husband, just as friend. Well, that's a big distinction for families of choice. So we need to, and on the policy side, you know, in the one of the focus groups that we did in Alberta, so we did separate groups with gay and bisexual men, lesbian and bisexual women, trans persons, and the fourth group were service providers. Well, it was a real eye-opener in one of the service provider groups in Edmonton, where they came across, these were people from Alberta Health who were very proud of themselves as having put policies in place with respect to end-of-life issues that they thought would make them accessible to all. Well, there ain't no such thing as one-size-fits-all. And it hadn't dawned on them that the wording of some of their forms was such that it scared away people from applying who did not see it as meaningful or friendly to them. So in this day and age, you know, we really do have to think about in our phraseology and our wording of gender identity and sexual orientation, and just not just asking, are you male or female?
Thank you. Okay. What, to the end? Could the time have moved that fast?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we have equal time in the second session as the first session?
Just a half hour.
Pardon me?
Just a half hour.
Okay. So let's open it up to the floor. We haven't had a chance to really discuss much on advanced care planning in terms of the future, so we don't want to lose sight of that. So we've got two things on the go here right now. We've got grief and bereavement on the one hand, and we've got advanced care planning on the other. There are lots of issues with advanced healthcare planning in terms of the communities accessing advanced healthcare planning. We know the government's interested in promoting advanced care planning, but there's lots of problems implementing it. So let's open it up to the floor and see if we can get some creative discussion going here between the panel and yourselves regarding any of these matters.
I can start with a question,
sure.
And I did ask Dr. Dosar before the break. I recently had an opportunity to meet the BC Seniors Advocate, Isabel McKenzie, and her mandate includes housing, finances, health care, all in relation to seniors. Ageism is another one. Nowhere in her mandate does there appear to be anything related to spirituality, sexuality, and racial communities. And I was wondering if I missed something or if they are, in fact, included in her mandate.
Well, when it comes to matters of spirituality, and we already had a discussion, is that we live in a secular society. You know, the ethos is secular. But when it comes to racialized minorities, a number of them are faith-based communities. And their spirituality is not recognized because there is no public space for them to articulate what it means to be spiritual. And so I guess it's time that we now work towards a model of a pluralistic society at the fundamental and structural level, whereby we would feel comfortable talking about spiritual issues in the public sphere. For example, in the Muslim community, if you meet another person from your community, you would say inshallah, you know, what Allah wishes. Or you say salam alaikum, may peace be with you. Now, these are the terms that I do not see being used in the public sphere. And I think that these terms are, you know, have a lot of value, not only for the Muslim community, but for everybody when it comes to addressing existential issues of life. So I think, again, you know, my main point that I want to make is that we need to work towards expanding existing models, existing policies, existing programs, so that we are in a position to enrich ourselves as well, and at the same time recognize and acknowledge the realities of multicultural groups in Canada.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I would say that, yes, they are included in her mandate under the broader heading of quality of life. And if anybody can be responsive to the community and can make it happen, it's Isabel McKenzie. I don't know if you saw yesterday or the day before, the report on housing, because I thought she did a really good job at getting at the main issues. So I would urge those of you from the spiritual and the faith communities, if you have some issues, do contact Isabel.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Any questions? I know I'm wondering if any of you, because I'm assuming a number of you are from faith communities yourselves, as well as the panelists, if you have thoughts about the interface between the healthcare communities and the spiritual communities, the religious communities, because it seems to me if there ever was an area that overlapped, it's this one. So in terms of advanced healthcare planning, I'm wondering what help the Anglican community, the Catholic community, the Muslim community, the Sikh community, the LGBT community, the Hindu community, etc., has with respect to being able to advance the cause of advanced healthcare planning in their own communities. In other words, how can the hospitals, the clinics, the health authorities interface and help? And how can the faith communities help the health authorities to promote advanced care planning? Because this is one of these somewhat rare situations where the government of BC actually has the same interests as the faith communities. I'm not saying it doesn't overlap at other times, but this is one of those ones where, you know, the dollars and cents actually overlap with doing the right thing. Because we know that if we do not have more people with advanced healthcare plans, we will continue to pump the chests of 90-year-olds who do not want their chests pumped and who do not want to be stuck on a respirator and do not want to spend the last 2 weeks of their life in an ICU, where on average we spend 60% of all the healthcare dollars spent on an individual in their entire life in the last 2 weeks. So there's a real solid, believable reason why the government should want to do this, because we know dollars and cents are always factoring in the background. So when the right thing overlaps with good stewardship, and it overlaps with spirituality and end of life, I mean, to me, this is a fascinating area for exploration. Should be rocketing, but it's not. It's not skyrocketing. Why is it not skyrocketing? I'm just tossing that out to anybody.
Maybe I could answer part of that question, and that there is an organization called Denominational Health, in which is made up of Catholics, Protestants, Jewish, and other faith traditions. And Susan House is the kind of the chairperson of that group, and she advocates an awful lot on behalf of the faith communities with the BC government, is meeting with the BC government all the time, and is putting this before them. I know just from the conversation this morning, I am going to go back to my bishop, Bishop Melissa, who was invited to be here today, but she's busy with our synod, which is like our parliament, so she phoned me and asked me to come in her place. I'll be going back to her and engaging in conversation with her about advanced planning and directives and those type of things within the Anglican Diocese and U.S. Minister to see what it is we can do to help promote and get the questions going and the dialogue going and get some movement within the Anglican Church to have folks look at this very important issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Pertaining to that, but could that group do a glossary of greetings, multicultural, to give to us that we might use? Do you think? A thought.
I can pass it on to Denominational Health, yeah.
Anybody else? Questions about anything? Anything at all?
Did you get a grandson yet?
No, it's not like I'm expecting necessarily today. It could be weeks from now, but I'm on alert. I've been told I must be on alert. Otherwise, I may never get to see him. I don't know. So anyone sitting there being sheepish, wanting to put their hand up but feeling shy? How much time have we got, Ruth? Is that it? Oh, do I hear a question from a shy person on the side there? So she's having courage, so we want to encourage that.
One of the things I'm interested in is sort of this question of, is there something that faith communities can do that the state can simply not do or cannot? And faith communities, I would suggest, are communities that are de facto caring communities. So you have all these people who have predisposition to care and have really a mandate in some covenantal sense to care. And is there something that they can do if they had... I don't know if it's education or... I know I'm involved with a mental health ministry working on supporting faith communities to help out with members of the congregation or parish who are experiencing mental illness. And it seems to me that faith communities might also be emboldened or educated or supported to provide end-of-life care or hospice care or bereavement supports in a way that the state can simply cannot do. And I'm wondering if somebody would like to speak to sort of what can faith communities do that cannot be done through the state.
It's a great question. I'm not sure who wants to answer that first. Elaine?
I'm just going to say, like, you're sort of talking about public versus private in a sense, like the so things that the government can't do. I think a lot of our faith community are probably already involved, maybe could be more involved. Look at the people here amongst you who are volunteers and with palliative care, for example. So what I think that, and I think you're right to say that you're sort of geared as a faith community to trying to be helpful, to try to be a good Christian. And so it's an interesting question, though, to how can we maximize or put together the needs with the great resource we have in the faith communities. Like maybe going in two different church communities and saying there's a shortage of people for palliative care, or like Marilyn's opening up this new hospice in the North Shore, and she's going to be looking at hospice or at palliative care. She's putting together and so like she'll be looking for volunteers, for example. So maybe there should be some mechanism whereby the people that are looking for volunteers have somehow contacts the sources, like the as you're mentioning. That's an interesting thing I think I would like to follow up on that on the North Shore.
Dr. Dosa?
I can respond to that very briefly. I think when it comes to the state, we are looking at hierarchical relationships. We are looking at rigid policies and rigid programs. When it comes to faith-based communities, there is a demolition of hierarchies. There is more of a care that is oriented towards a person and more of intimate relationship, intimate in a neutral sense. So I think there is this distinction that I would take into account.
Thank you. There's a lady at the back with her hand up. Sorry, can you use the microphone, please?
I just attended the conference in Bristol on compassionate communities that's been spearheaded by Dr. Kelleher. And the last comment that you just made is a powerful one, and your question's an interesting one. And it has to do with the ways in which institutions and volunteers thereby that are affiliated with institutions are obliged to abide by certain policies that are related to insurance, right? Whereas in the context of community-led, community-driven initiatives that have to do with grief and bereavement support, for example, or compassionate neighbors or befrienders, any of a variety of kinds of initiatives that are present in other countries like the UK. People can be much more involved in direct care than they can be when they're attached, for example, to a hospice. So one of the things that you see happening in the UK is that hospices are facilitating the development of volunteer programs, but volunteer programs that are community-driven. So the volunteers are not volunteering for the hospice, although the hospices have a great bunch of volunteers as well, but they're just getting training that's facilitated by the hospice, and therefore they're much freer to engage with patients and families, and even people that aren't necessarily on the radar as unwell. So I think that that's a direction that we are needing to go, and the faith-based communities are a perfect environment to take the lead on that.
Thank you. Well, we're almost out of time. I guess I just leave you with the thought that maybe it's not just what the faith communities can do and what the healthcare communities can do, but what can they do together? No better example in my thoughts than the Catholics, actually, and St. Paul's Hospital, for example, and many other facilities, where they're working cooperatively together, and I think you can do great things when you partner. We often think of these two principalities as totally separate from each other, but they don't always have to be. That's not really what church and state, separation of church and state in the U.S. means. So thank you to each one of our panelists today for all of their heartfelt and well-thought-out comments and for coming here on their own time to do this. And thank you to each of you for your participation today. And thank you to Ruth. And I thank Lorraine, but she's not here. And I'll just pass it to you. Ruth, you may have some final comments for people in terms of instructions. I don't know.
I think lunch is going to be served in the lounge, and the AGM is going to be starting very shortly. So to pick up your lunch and head into the AGM if you are a member. And I think that's it. So thank you very much to the panelists and to Greg. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.